5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running.
There is no other institution that has the ability, uniquely.
Without a heritage, every generation starts over.
Ask not.
To remind the current regime.
What your country.
We the people tell the government what it is allowed to do.
To get back in their box and stay there.
Liftoff.
From the Heritage Foundation, this is Heritage Explains.
On a dark winter's night, on December 16th, 1773, a group of men dressed as Mohawk warriors boarded three ships moored in Boston Harbor. Over the course of the next several hours, they dumped over 340 chests of tea into the harbor. These Americans, who identified themselves as the Sons of Liberty, were staging a protest against what they viewed to be unlawful taxation by the British government. It was a protest that set the stage for the American Revolution itself. And protest is one of the key characteristics of American public life. The Constitution protects the right of freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, and that has been used for noble purposes for over two centuries now. Consider the abolitionist movement, Martin Luther King's famous March on Washington, and the National March for Life. And yet, in the summer of 2020, Americans witnessed the Black Lives Matter demonstrations that swept across the country. These were often violent and destructive, and our media, government, and civil institutions seemed to be powerless to respond to them in any meaningful way. Many Americans sensed that we were seeing a movement that was not set up to ensure American freedoms, but to upend them. In the years since, conservatives have gotten busy trying to understand and counter the new Marxism that has gained purchase in American political life. In this episode of Heritage Explains, Heritage Vice President Victoria Coates interviews Senior Fellow Mike Gonzalez. Mike and Heritage Research Fellow Katie Gorka have just finished a book on this topic. It's called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. Take a listen.
Welcome to Heritage Explains. I'm Victoria Coates, your host for today, welcoming with great pleasure a treasure of the Heritage Foundation, Mike Gonzalez, who is the Angelus T. Arredondo E Pluribus Unum Senior Fellow at the Davis Institute at Heritage, of course, to discuss his important new book that has just published today, Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It, which he has written with my good friend and our former Heritage colleague, Katie Gorka. And so Katie is not joining us this afternoon, but she will be doing the event from Heritage on Wednesday, so you can expect to hear from her then. The book is literally hot off the presses. And I wanted to do this discussion with Mike as quickly as possible to get it in front of all of our Heritage members, because I do think this is a critical book. And for those of you who don't know about my checkered past and my PhD in art history, you might wonder why I wanted to do a podcast about the culture wars. And the reason I wanted to is they have become just that. Culture has been weaponized by the far left in the United States. It is then turned into a bludgeon to try to implement social change. And what Katie and Mike have done in this book is go through how this happened, what the ramifications of it are, and then most hopefully, and I think most importantly, how we can fix it. Because the good news is that the authors believe that the situation has not gone around the bend, that we still have time if we all pull together to write it and to make sure that we can reclaim some of these institutions that are fundamental to the defense of Western civilization. So, Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Victoria. And I must say that for the last 3 months, I've been introducing myself here at Heritage at Lunches as I report to Victoria Coates, and I've been doing that proudly. And I've always understood your interest in these matters. In fact, you've opened my eyes, because every time I talk about authors and philosophers, you always bring up the visual arts and how important. And not that I had ignored that before. You know, I grew up going to El Prado in Madrid. My mother forced me, and good on her, because it actually, I love going to museums today as an adult. But it's the paintings are also such an important part of our heritage in the West. What happened in the Renaissance? What happened before the Renaissance? What Michelangelo? You know, all of them, Raphael, Titian. So thank you. I know that you understand these cultural issues and their importance very well.
Well, first question, which is what I always ask authors about books, is why did you write this book?
I've been trying to make my fellow Americans understand that what is happening is not happenstance, that what we're seeing since, especially since 2020, since the riots of 2020, but definitely since Ferguson in 2014 and 2013, and since the 80s, really, and why not since the 60s, is not a coincidence that that there are people intent on cultural genocide, on changing the culture, of completely abolishing the world order as it hitherto existed, to paraphrase badly something Karl Marx wrote in the 1800s. And they took Marxist, economic Marxism, and put it through a cultural prism and came up with the idea that what we needed was to wipe out the culture as it existed and replace it with something else. And I see it clearly. I saw what happened with the BLM riots in 2020 very, very clearly. The media was trying to pull a fast one on us and calling it a much-needed racial reckoning and ignoring the background of the architects of Black Lives Matter. But I don't want to overemphasize Black Lives Matter only, because they're only the shock troops, the street element, the street violence elements of something that is very deep, very disturbing, and something that Americans, I think, understand intuitively and are trying to fight against.
And how did you and Katie come to collaborate on this project?
Well, as you said before, she was my colleague then at Heritage. We talked about it a lot. We wrote a paper together in 2021, I believe, that was a very successful paper, a special report. And we thought of turning it into a book, and I talked to my publishers, and they said, absolutely, let's do that. So we were able to expand a report that I think was quite long to begin with, 18,000 words, into a book that is close to 100,000 words, and able to go in more deeply into several chapters.
Excellent. And I am also a proud Encounter author, so it's all in the family. I'd picked a couple of different passages from the book, basically just sentences that I found really striking, and I thought I would read them to you, and maybe you would sort of expand on them for our listeners to explain why these issues are pertinent to their everyday lives. And the first one is from the introduction, and it reads, "The use of race, sex, sexual orientation, climate, social justice, gender, and animal rights, the denigration of beauty and the sublime, the consequent elevation of ugliness, chaos, and disorder, the decimation of the family and the abandonment of God, these and many other diverse struggles are front in a larger war."
That's actually a sentence. My fear when you said that is you're going to pick only sentences that Katie wrote. That's actually a sentence that she and I both worked together on. And I can tell you, I recognize strains of Katie's and strains of me, and that something that a guy who, a very intelligent man, David Horowitz, I'm sure you've read him, a former Marxist revolutionary from the 60s who turned against Marxism, something he used to say all the time, and he still says, he's still around, I saw him in Los Angeles about 2 years ago, is that the issue was never the issue. The issue is the revolution. And we're seeing that today as more and more protesters, ostensibly for Gaza, for the Palestinians, or protesters for climate, or protesters for race, come out and say quite clearly, no, what we want to do is dismantle American civilization, dismantle the West. There was a Gaza protester who just said exactly that, and Elon Musk retweeted him. There was Chrystia Freeland, the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, whom I used to know, by the way. She was a journalist when I was a journalist. After I was a journalist, she was a journalist for the Financial Times. When I was in the Bush administration, she went on to join the Trudeau government. She just gave a speech last week in which she said that the climate challenge was so that we could no longer afford to have democracy and the capitalist system. And democracy and the capitalist system are the enemy here. Not for nothing do all the architects of BLM and the main architects of critical race theory, Kimberlé Crenshaw, Derrick Bell, Richard Delgado, their goal is a revolutionizing goal. They take issue with free markets. They take issue with representative democracy, which they call a sham. And they quote Antonio Gramsci. They quote the people, who the West Europeans who became Western Marxists, who took Marxist economic ideas and put them through a cultural prism. So all these things are, and Eric Mann, a community organizer, a former terrorist, who was a member of the Weather Underground, who then in 1989, by the way, that's a key year, we can return to that if you want, founded the Labor Community Strategy Center in Los Angeles. He gave an interview to a Venezuelan TV station in 2015, and he said that also. He said that, look, for us Marxists, whether it's race, whether it's sex, whether it's climate, this is a little division of labor that we have. Our goal is to dismantle this white settler state that is the most oppressive state in world history. By that, he means the United States, by the way. So let that sink in. So that is really one of the key things that we set out to describe in this book and to explain. That, as Horowitz said, the issue is never the issue. The issue is the revolution.
No, and I think that's a critical point, because I think a lot of Americans would think that we're just talking about run-of-the-mill Democrats here, people with whom we have policy differences. And the fact of the matter is, the reason Marxism is in the title is this is nothing more nor less than an attempt at a communist revolution, that it is designed to destroy the United States system, not adjust it, not change it through debate. So while we're on that, do you want to go into 1989 a little bit?
Yeah, because, and let me go back to Mann. I don't know if I said this just now, but he recruits, that's his word, which he writes in a book in 2011. He recruits Patrice Couleurs in the late 90s when she was 17 into his Labor Community Strategy Center. And lo and behold, more than a dozen years later, she's one of the architects of Black Lives Matter. He founds the Labor Community Strategy Center in 1989. What else is founded in 1989? Critical race theory comes out as whole cloth, well, not whole cloth creation. The name itself comes in a meeting that was held in Madison, in a convent of all places, in Madison, Wisconsin. Critical legal theorists who were of color, most of them were African American, but there were a few Japanese Americans, one famous Mexican American, Richard Delgado, and they found critical race theory and they give it that word in 1989. In 1989, Felicity Barringer, the former bureau chief for the New York Times, actually writes a key piece, an article in the New York Times of all places. We talk a lot about this in our book, in which he says, there's something very strange happening. Communism is losing ground in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. I was in Hong Kong at the time, and we all thought that communism was also going to become extinct in China because we were watching Tiananmen Square. And she said, but Marxism is making incredible inroads in American universities. And this is by the way, I recommend to everybody to read this in the Wayback Machine, Felicity Barringer, 1989, New York Times. And she says, also, it's not in the hard sciences and the universities where communism is gaining a foothold. It's in the humanities and it's in the law schools. And that is an incredible, that's an insightful observation that she makes, because that shows that evolution I've been talking about from economic Marxism to cultural Marxism. So 1989, there's a couple of other things that happened in 1989, of which I forget at the moment. 1989 is a key year in which the former Flower Children and former terrorists, radical students of the 1960s, let's not forget, quite a few of them had a terrorist stage, not just the weather on the ground, but the Black Panthers, the Symbionese Liberation Army, the Puerto Rican Liberation Front. They give up armed struggle and they realize that they have to take over the universities and the institutions to infiltrate the institutions and indoctrinate people from within society. In 89 is also the year that Harold Bloom publishes The Closing of the American Mind, or 88, I think. So things are bubbling up to a head in the late 80s in that the institutions, especially the academy, is being taken over.
No, I think it is critical. And of course, I mean, the Berlin Wall fell.
Sorry, I forgot. I buried the lead, as they say in journalism.
So you, I think a lot of people could be forgiven for thinking that communism was over.
Right.
Essentially, we were going to befriend the Chinese. They were going to become our great economic partner. Russia was going to become a democratic, potentially member of NATO. That was actually tossed around as a thing. So I think that in a way gave the radicals cover to continue to meet and foment and plot. And that's the Berenger article is something I had hit on in the book. And one of the other passages I had highlighted is at the beginning of chapter 5, which is the takeover. So this is the sort of thing you will learn about in this excellent book. That, and as a recovering art historian, this really struck me. But because they cared about the cultural infrastructure of society, they captured the faculties of education, law, and ethnic studies. They didn't want to poison the water supply. They wanted to poison as many minds as they could. So they're looking for conversion, not just killing.
Right. And this is the result of Western Marxists realizing in the 20s, when they tried to do a copycat revolution, two of them, one in Germany, the other one in Italy, and they failed because the worker did not want to throw out the established order. The worker had no interest. The worker just wanted to have better factory conditions, just like the worker did in Michigan and Ohio here in this country. They came up with the idea, why is Marx wrong? Why aren't we having constant revolutions to overthrow the state? Why isn't the bourgeois wife being raped and massacred constantly? They said, well, it's because the worker has become his own oppressor. The bourgeois, the owner of capital, no longer needs to use oppressive means, no longer needs to use cruel means and violence to oppress the worker. The worker has bought into the cultural norms that the rich and powerful set up in the first place to remain rich and powerful. So we need to change the conceptual superstructure. We need to change the cultural format. And that's what they set out to do.
Then the last piece before we turn to the more hopeful part of the interview that I wanted to get after was from chapter 7, which is titled Sexualizing Children and the Attack on the Family, which is something, you know, if you trace from the 1950s, really the 1960s, on the destruction of the American family, nuclear family, has resulted in more trauma, more destroyed wealth, more dysfunction than any other social force, and particularly and egregiously in the African American community, where it has become almost an intolerable burden. But the chapter begins, of all the ways that next gen Marxism is attacking the culture of the United States, none is more disturbing and ultimately more destructive than the attack on the family and the sexualization of children. And that, you know, when I read it yesterday afternoon, it was just went off like a bell because of what happened on Sunday, when the President of the United States decreed that Easter Sunday, the holiest day on the calendar, a day that is about children, it is about rejoicing, it is about recovery from sin, would also be this year Transgender Day of Visibility. And you know, that was almost a grotesque juxtaposition of what should be a wonderful day of celebration and family. I know you celebrated with your family. We celebrated with ours. It should be this magical spiritual time of togetherness, that it didn't occur to anybody in the White House that this was a bad idea. I think points to the tremendous wisdom of what you guys are talking about in this chapter. And so just to have that happen in recent days is why I think this book is so important. So if you could, you know, maybe describe a little bit of what happens in this chapter and why it is so pervasive.
So people can't see me, but in the first part of your question, I was shaking my head vigorously, Victoria, when you're talking about how much it undermines society when you attack the family. And then when you started talking about the transgender day of visibility, you just gave me chills because it was absolutely grotesque. And he signed this proclamation on Good Friday. And this is a distillation of changing the cultural matrix. We have a Judeo-Christian cultural matrix. There's nothing more Judeo-Christian than Easter, when Christ celebrates his Last Supper with his friends, and it's actually a Seder dinner, which is the Passover. And then he is taken over and he is crucified the next morning. And 3 days later, we have this explosion of joy because we understand this beautiful thing that there is redemption in our lives. And to replace this with this depravity, this grotesque notion that the human body needs to be mutilated because people have been born, God has put people in the wrong body. There's nothing more illustrative of what I'm talking about here. The destruction of the family, the use of queer theory and gender theory is one of the elements that, when added to cultural Marxism, gives us what Katie and I call next-gen Marxism. But let's recognize that this is a strand that begins in the Manifesto of 1848 when Karl Marx and his sugar daddy, Friedrich Engels, write, abolish the family, abolish the family. They understand that the family is the basic unit of society. You abolish that, and you begin to destroy the cultural matrix. And then George Lukács, the cultural commissar of the short-lived Hungarian Soviet in 1919, actually begins to, has teachers begin to teach depravity to school children in Hungary, which did not go well at all with Hungarian peasants and Hungarian workers. And the Hungarian Soviet lasted, you remember how many days? I think it was 300 days. It was very short-lived. Mm-hmm. And George Lukács.
It wasn't very popular.
Yeah, it was, exactly. And then, this idea of destroying the family from within, you see it again in Marcuse, Herbert Marcuse, who belongs to the Frankfurt School. He's in America in 1957, and his first breakaway bestseller is Eros and Civilization, in which he explicitly says that he wants that the powerful sexual urge must be used to destroy the family from within, and he enjoins American housewives to cheat on their husbands, and then we see, with Judith Butler, she's incredibly powerful, in the sense that a lot of the ideas that we think today, this idea that you're wrong, born in the wrong body. And then you have the performative genders. All goes back to Judith Butler, who is a cultural Marxist in the sense that she is very influenced by Ernesto Laclau, by Althusser, by Antonio Gramsci. So this is something that begins with Marx, abolishing the family, lives through every Marxist since. And by the way, Black Lives Matter, in its 13-point, in their 13-point manifesto, also had abolished the Western-oriented nuclear family until my colleague Andy Olivastro and I wrote a piece in July of 2020 for the New York Post. When we reprinted the piece at the Heritage Foundation, it was read by over a million people. It was read by many more people, I think, in the New York Post. And in Black Lives Matter, good Marxists that they are, they take that point down from their website. All of a sudden, the 13-point program becomes a 12-point program. Although in Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, they still have the 13 points. So this is something that exists throughout. Sorry for the long answer. Because of the recognition that of all the little platoons, the Birkin little platoons that hold the society together, the family is the most important. Not the individual, the family.
No, I think that is it is the critical point. And again, not to belabor this point, but for nobody at the White House to say, gee, it would really be a good idea to maybe do this Monday, It's not that you can't have your transgender day of visibility, although there's apparently a large number of these things on the calendar.
Right.
But that this was inevitable, that it was going to coincide with Easter at some point if they chose the date of March 31st. So saying, oh, it has to be. I mean, it's only been going on for however many years now. I think Easter goes back a little bit farther than that and, you know, maybe has a little bit more of a divine stamp on it. And so, you know, that this has to go on regardless of who is inconvenienced or offended or, you know, feels their beliefs, you know, are being belittled. That doesn't matter. It just has to go on. And that's what they're really capitalizing on.
I did a word count today. And the Easter statement that President Biden and Dr. Jill sent out to the American people was 96 words. The proclamation for Transgender Day of Visibility was 666 words. And it was, by the way, it was missing in the Spanish language edition of the White House.
I'm amazed by that. Yeah, and what we've gotten back from our friends on MSNBC and CNN is outrage that we could possibly say this about our devout Catholic president.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the not very conservative Archbishop, Cardinal of Washington, actually called him a cafeteria Catholic, saying, and not in a good way, that he goes into the Catholic cafeteria, chooses what he wants, and doesn't, in what other tenets of the church, he just leaves on the tray.
No, I think that's very much the case. Now, in our remaining time, as I said, I'd like to get to the more hopeful piece of this, which is what to do about it, because I think a lot of people feel helpless in the face of this assault on our culture and on our civilization. But as we have discussed, you know, I was very struck by the speech, the Kirk lecture that Ayaan Hirsi Ali gave last month here at the Heritage Foundation. And then before that, the address that Ambassador Ronald Lauder gave at our U.S.-Israel event in October, both of which are available on the Heritage website as major papers that were delivered here. And in both cases, they had as their theme the defense of Western civilization. And, you know, Ambassador Lauder reacting in the days after the terrorist attacks of October 7th was very clear that now, you know, academia has been captured. And, you know, we cannot go on funding and supporting these institutions as beloved as they may be. I'm going to go later this month and speak at my alma mater, which is also his, the University of Pennsylvania. I have not only university police, I have not only Philadelphia police, but I also have personal security provided by the Heritage Foundation to visit the campus of my alma mater to talk about Middle East issues. So that's how far gone that is. And Ayaan then spoke about a theme that you weave through your book, which is that it is not enough to simply be fond of Western civilization or to study it or to quietly support it. Those who want to defend it have to stand up and do so. And so I really think that is the theme of Chapter 9 of what to do. But I thought you might want to give our listeners some specific pointers on that.
Yeah, you're very courageous, Victoria, in doing that. And I think courage is needed. I'm optimistic. Obviously, a lot of work needs to be done. And we could lose civilization. We could lose America. But, you know, we had a representative from Utah, Burgess Owens, here at Heritage about 4 weeks ago. And he said he revealed he was a cancer survivor. And he said, look, I'm here because they caught it early. And they say, I think we have caught this thing early in America. And we can save America. And I think that he is right. We have caught it early. The American people are rebelling against all of this. They understand in intrinsic guttural way that this is not, that this is completely bizarre and against objective truth and everything they know to be true and holy and hollow and true, in one word. And they're fighting. And we need to convince policymakers that they need to help the American people, give them help, pass laws, pass, you know, rules that help the American people fight this. The American people cannot be left defenseless like the people, like, for example, the troops in Braveheart. We need activists. We need journalists. And a lot of good work is being done by new media, by the way. We're obviously not in the New York Times and the Washington Post, but the Washington Free Beacon, the Washington Examiner are writing really good stuff. So I think the American people are rebelling. The raft of cultural changes that were put in by our cultural gatekeepers and our legislators since 2020, when they were intimidated by the riots, have woken up the American people. We need to show up for them. We need to help them. So I want the listeners to the challenge is immense, but I think we're going to win this thing because I believe in the American people, and I think we just need to expose this and then give the solutions as we do in the final chapter of our book.
Can you just pick one of those solutions? And
yeah, I mean, helping, and this is something that is happening already, helping the different states fight CRT and DEI. Mm-hmm. For example, as Texas has done, as Florida has done, saying, no, you cannot, and what you're doing is you're defending the Constitution. The Constitution says, for example, that you cannot compel speech. The Constitution also says that you cannot use race to divide people, that if you take government money, you cannot discriminate on the basis of race. So you say, well, the First Amendment means something and the 14th Amendment means something. In strip DEI out of state universities and in private universities that take taxpayer money, because helping state lawmakers, this is something that is happening already. Obviously, the White House is not going to do this work, so the federal government is not going to do this work. We have a lot of in some districts in blue states as well. We need to help them as well, That is one area where obviously that is happening already, and we need to increase that.
No, and I think it is a very strong focus of Heritage and Heritage Action to engage on these state level efforts, and it can go down to the county level, the school board level, where there are opportunities to intervene. And I think you will find in that chapter what to do. A specific menu of actions that you can take as members of your communities to stand up against this. And it, as Mike said, is not inevitable and it isn't true. And so we don't have to. It's kind of more like a 1984 thing where you're being forced to say something that isn't true. We don't have to do that. This is still America. And I think ultimately, particularly in this election year, despite the somewhat disturbing material that exposes, the plot of the next gen Marxists over the last recent decades, winds up being a very hopeful, very positive book. And so I just invite you to say any closing words you'd like to say to our listeners. And thank you very much.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. And thank you to the Heritage Foundation, where I work, for giving me the opportunity to write, giving me the opportunity to act. Every day that I come in here to save the country, America is worth saving. I wasn't born in this country. I have lived at least a year in 7 different countries all over the world as a foreign correspondent. America, all these things you hear about America, that we live in an oppressive society, that the systemic racism, that our cultural matrix is white supremacy, these are fallacies. This is not true. America is still what Abraham Lincoln called the last best hope of earth. And it's very much worth saving. If just as humanity is worth saving, America is worth saving. It's worth fighting for.
Well, thanks, Mike. Thanks to Katie as well. And thanks to everyone who listens to Heritage Explains.
Thank you to Victoria Coates, Mike Gonzalez, and Katie Gorka for their contributions to today's episode. You can follow their work on X with Victoria at Victoria Coates, Mike at Gundy Salvis, and Katie at Gorka Katie. You can find a link to Next Gen Marxism, what it is and how to combat it, in the show notes. Thank you, as always, to you for listening to Heritage Explains. If you have any thoughts or feedback for us, we look forward to hearing from you. You can reach out to heritageexplains@heritage.org. Take care, and we'll see you next week.
Heritage Explains is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. It's written and produced by Mark Ghani, Lauren Evans, and John Popp.